My name is Harriet Tramer, and thanks for joining me today when I host Reaching for the Gold. The show is broadcast every other Tuesday afternoon at this time, and I hope we will make it part of your weekly schedule. My first guest today is Dan Hartley, who goes about healing people in an interesting way. He's a songwriter who hopes to make an impact in Nashville through his music. By his accounting, music can help to keep people young. My second guest, Dr. Donnie Rudd, has developed a device that can help people of all ages heal from bruises, trauma, and other incidents. Don, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Well, I'm doing good, Harriet. How are you today?
We're doing okay. We're doing okay. Now, we have talked, and you indicated that the chances of getting a record published and being a hit and getting some money and all that good stuff from it are not real high. Can you tell us a little bit about the odds, how that works?
I sure will. About 4 years ago, when I got serious about writing toward getting towards Nashville towards writing, I've been writing for about 26 years. And I sat down with some folks and went over some of the stuff I had, and they showed me where I was missing it, some folks that had been to Nashville, and where I needed to catch up on, so I got all that out of the way. The second thing, I joined the Nashville Songwriters Club in Nashville that critiques 12 songs a year for $150 to give you an idea of where you're strong or weak in your songs, if they have even a chance of making it. I was strong in that, but I had areas they pointed out that I was able to start developing. But one of the things they did while I was there was when they got through talking about what they did, and because I went to Nashville to talk with them, they took me outside and showed me a building with about 200 windows, about a five-story building. And they said inside of every window there's 3 to 5 writers writing the next hit song. So these people are staff writers. They get paid about $32 a year on salary against commission. They have to write 3 hit songs in the top 10 every year, or they're let go by that company.
So the competition is very stiff.
Well, you got professional guys that are very good at songwriting, and then they're on contract. So a lot of times they get listened to first. Their companies do. And so when I decided to go for it with some stuff I'd written, I thought, well, I got the odds of about 100 million to 1. I figured that was my odds. One man told me and said, run for president, you may hit that next. And so I happened to come across a good demo service. I'd listened to a bunch of them, but this particular one is played with some of the best in Nashville. George Strait, all of them, and he has his own television show in Nashville, and he does demo work. He's very good, and when he got through demoing the 2 songs I sent, he put them on a Nashville level. The second stage is getting a hold of what is called a song plugger. There are different companies, different pluggers. This particular plugger I had come across 2 or 3 years ago, kept him in mind, and I said, if I ever do it, I'll pay him. And you pay the pluggers to go out and plug your songs. What he told me about a month ago, I've been at it 6 months now, and I have different ones that are that have my songs in their mix now. But he said the odds of getting in the front door, that 90% of the tapes that are given to the producers to start listening for the songs they're going to put on an album, it's over a 6 to 9 month process, is 90% of them never get through the front door. So for the last 6 months, I've had 2 artists that has kept them for 5 months. I have 2 more artists, one being Corbin Easton, other one being Gary Allen, that are well known in Nashville. They've had it over 2 months now, or 3 months now. And then I got 2 more artists that's a month or going on 2 months with those 2 artists. And so I've had probably about 5 or 6 artists that looked at the songs, kept them for at least 4 weeks to 8, and decided what and what they want to do, because a lot goes into how they pick songs for an album. So the odds were pretty slim at that point getting in, but I beat the odds going in.
But what makes people want to get into this business when it is so competitive and the chances are not great, no matter how good they might be, that they will ever have a hit song? What motivates people in that way?
Well, I wrote a song called that I hadn't got out there yet called Old Nashville Dream, and it's just having that inner desire somewhere down deep. When I started writing songs, it wasn't for the purpose of distribution or any of those things. It really was to soothe the savage beast. In other words, I wrote because of what I felt, and it helped my emotions, and that's over 20-something years ago. And the way I started writing was unique because I decided one day at 21 I wanted to play the piano. Took lessons for a month. That didn't work. That was an old dog teaching new tricks, and that wasn't going to ever work. So I stopped. 2 months later, I woke up one morning, and I thought, if old Daniel can get out of the lion's den praying 3 times a day, I can play that piano by doing that. So I started praying 3 times a day, 5 minutes at a time. 3 months later, I sat down and played my first song, and what God would do would give me words of a song to write and find the chords. And that's how he taught me to play the piano. And
find
so
the
I
chords.
Just started, yeah, the chords on the piano, like G, C, F. And so by doing that, that's how I learned to begin to play the piano and writing songs. And every time a song come, I would learn sometimes some new chords I hadn't learned. And so it wasn't until about 3 years ago that I'd really decided to try to shoot for a high level. And I thought I had some songs that was close, maybe in the top 20, top 30 at least, because I listen to songs on radio, and I'm thinking, I know I write better than that, and that's making it in the top 30. Didn't know if I had anything that would make the top 10. So that's when I started going after it. And I decided, well, I'm going to go for the top. I'm going to go for the gusto and see what happens. And so I sent the plugger 10 songs, and I asked him to tell me if I had a song he thought would be worth listening to. And out of the 10, he picked 2 because of all the money I had to spend for him to do. He did pick 2, could have just picked them, be picking them. But he was pleasantly surprised when he got the demos back from Gary Carter Studios. And so far, they've made it through the front door and still sticking there.
Now, from what you're describing, there is more involved here than just a desire to make money. Like if you play the lottery, you're not trying to prove any emotional point or political point or religious point. Boom, put down these numbers, hope you get numbers back.
Right.
From what you describe, this is more than you might encounter with the lottery, where people are, again, putting down money, or going to Vegas, put down money, hope to get more back. What you describe is some real desire to express yourself and get feelings expressed.
That is 100% correct. Songwriting gets down to, of course, there are people that are paid, you know, to write the hits and stuff, and a lot of them have emotion in songs. But when you listen to songs, some songs has feeling in them, and some it's just plain Jane type songs. A lot of words, a lot of said, but not really feelings in it. To me, I write. There are two kinds of writers, Harriet. There's a writer that can sit down and write a song about a subject, and then there's the songwriter that writes from songs coming to them that are inspirational. That's the two kinds of writers. Now, sometimes both of those sides cross into one writer. Take like Willie Nelson. He can write about a subject, or he'll have inspirational songs like Patsy Cline's song, Crazy, that came to him by inspiration. And he wrote that song. So I'm an inspirational-only writer, and so what I feel is what comes out through the songs that I write. And so it means more to me about that than it does anything else.
Now, you're talking about Willie Nelson. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nelson is 80. He's still out there singing. We talk about aging in this program, so I would like to dwell on that topic a minute.
Okay.
Is there something about music in general that keeps you young? Is there something revitalizing about it?
I think it is for me, because a lot of writers, some of them were what I call tortured writers. They went through a lot of emotional up and down in their life, and so they express it through their writing. It's like a pressure cooker, Bob, on top of a pressure cooker. It allows the pressures of life to come out through that. I think it was a lot of that for me over the years. Wrote some fun songs, like Ray Stevens, Roger Miller type songs. They call them novelty songs. And like There Ain't Nothing Going On. And then, but a lot of the things I write is from the experiences I've had over 57 years, not as a child, but especially as a teenager coming through. One of the songs that we got in Nashville, it looks like it may go through, is Just Reminisce. And it had a lot to do with teenage years, of remembering things that were good in those years. So it does bring back a revitalization of happy times. And then at other times you express what somebody feels about a certain situation. The song She Needs to Get Away came through a year that we had 14 major setbacks that year, including my oldest son, that failed and split his skull, and they said he'd be dead by the time he hit the trauma unit, but yet he lived. That's who I was just talking to. Spent 2 years in the trauma unit. Just Reminisce came from that. I was going to Louisiana to see him at the trauma home, and that song helped me to get through that week, because I started remembering about good things, not something bad that happened, and it sort of gave me a lift, and I sang that a lot just to give me up. She Needs to Get Away came from my wife's line that about midway through that year. And she just called one day, and she's tired and everything that's went on. And she said, I just need to get away. And within about 30 minutes of me riding in the truck working, the line came to me. She's up at dawn, the coffee's on, husband's out the door. Another day of waking up to the day before. Mm-hmm. So that line came to me, and the tune came to me within 30 minutes of her saying that. But, you know, it's about life, but it does bring more back good life to you, and it's the way I express, you know, the things I see around me and what I feel.
Mm-hmm. Get back to some of the technique. Uh-huh. We discussed this before, but if you have opera, okay, somebody has to hit C above middle C, a tenor, and this great range and this great emoting. From what I understand in country western music, you have great emoting, but it's a different message. It's emoting, but it's not on the scale you go up. It's something that comes through in your voice. If you listen to somebody like Johnny Cash, boom, medium baritone all the way through, from his earliest singing till he passed. Is that a way in which country western music is ageless rather than responding to somebody aging?
I think so. You know, it's there's several styles in country, and of course you got a lot greater singers. You got Rascal Flatts, he has a tenor voice. So, you know, you got several tenors that's come along that's made it in the country feel that ordinarily you don't think of tenors being in there. And then you got, and they sing a little bit on the higher notes, but they ain't that high. And then you got the baritones from Johnny Cash to nowadays is Josh Turner. The guy that won Idol a couple years back, the young kid, he's got a baritone voice. And mm-hmm. So the ranges are ranging between there. Martina McBride is probably one of the most wide ranging of notes when she's saying Independence Day. Even though it has some of the what you're talking about, she hits some notes that are pretty hard for some people to hit in those things because her range is that good. So, but a lot of it's about emotion, feelings. The better singers end up emotionally tying in with their words and their songs to their audience, and they draw them in through that. Chesney is one that's really good. That's on the average tone. His tones stay the same. They're in the middle. He doesn't go high, doesn't go low, but his personality through his words really grab a hold of it, and he's kept that number one, two, three spot probably over the last 10 years. George Strait, one that doesn't get high, low, pretty well monotone through, but he sold more records now than Elvis did. He's at 53 singles. I think Elvis was at 51, mm-hmm. and he's the number one all time, so... When you think of Elvis, you think of some high notes, low notes, and but George Strait has now sold more number one singles than Elvis. Mm-hmm. And his was just a straight tone type voice, real pleasant.
Now, we were talking before, and in this day and age, you really have to bring it up about a song plugger and these minute chances and this and that.
Right.
Couldn't you revert to being a 25-year-old and put things on YouTube and plug them yourself and just hope they go viral? And, hey, wait a minute, I got 2 million hits. You better listen to me. Is that a game that maybe wasn't done previously, but people are having to think real young and say, hey, maybe I can do that no matter what their age?
Well, YouTube is making a star out of everybody and his brother. And I just had a brother-in-law that wrote a song about making his best friend mad over the Auburn game. I won't say the name of the song on the air here, but he got on YouTube and played it out. And he got probably over 1,000 hits on something that was sort of dumb and stupid. But he made it, and as far as YouTube. So a lot of young ones are going to YouTube with some of their songs and stuff. It's not something I want to do. As a man I send the demos to says, you sing just good enough to get it here. So I don't try to get on YouTube and sing. And I play just good enough to get it there. They say I play in straight chords a lot, and so it makes them easier to size the music up real quick and go from there. So, you know, for others, yeah, that may be a route for some of the young ones that like that. It's not for me. I had already picked my angles from the Nashville Songwriters Club to the next thing I would do would be a good demo, and the next thing would be a good plugger. And the guy I got is Chris Keaton, and he's been in the business over 14 years.
What would you say makes a song great? You say it might get included in the album if it's good enough. What makes it good enough? Is it the quality of the singing? Is it the showmanship? I mean, in this day and age, people go on the TV and make bizarre gestures, and woof, the next day they're all over everything. Is that great song? Is that showmanship? How do you meld these things together? A young person may be able to get more with showmanship. I don't know how appropriate it is for an older person.
It's sort of like acting. You go back to the days of Jimmy Stewart. He didn't need a lot of violence to act. He didn't need a lot of cussing to act. Jimmy Stewart was one of the greatest actors I grew up with. John Wayne. Same way. Great actor, even though he played in Cowboy movies that had a little gunplay and all. Nowadays, they have to cover up acting by what you're talking about. Same thing in the song feel, what makes a good song. Sometimes it's a unique melody that just catches the ear of people, and they say, I love that melody. They may hear or not hear all the words, but they love just the melody. Sometimes it's a line in the song that sticks out, that grabs them, and they remember that one line, and the song, they hold on to that song because that line really meant something to their life. And So it's different factors and why they choose a song. When the process goes, it's a 6 to 9 process, 6 to 9 months. What happens is a producer starts listening to over 1,000, sometimes up to 2,000 songs for the album because they're going to have about 500,000 invested in the project before they put an album out. So once he starts listening, they got an idea of what kind of songs they want on an album and sort of the general overall picture or message they're wanting to get out through the album. So they start gathering songs. They may pass up 50 songs that are really great songs, but they don't fit within that picture of what they're trying to portray through the album. And then once they do that, that'll go on for 6 to 9 months. He'll get it down to about anywhere from 300 to 100, whatever the singer wants to listen to. The singer and the rest of the people involved will sit down and listen to all those songs. And then once they get it down to that level, then they choose 15 songs out of it that fit within the structure of the album and fit within his vocal range of how he sings. Sometimes it's a great song. It doesn't match up with his voice. Like some of the producers that chose a song, I listened to the singers that they were representing's voice, knew that those two songs wouldn't make it with those two guys because their voice is different. Now, why they chose to start with, I don't know. But they did. Sometimes kept it a month, sometimes 2 months. But the different reasons why they do, they get it down to the 15, and hopefully you land on one of the 15 and at that point. And then there's a step further from that. Once they get to 15, they produce the album, which may take another 2 or 3 months. Then, once they get ready to release it, if your song, they spend about 24 hours in a room, all of them, singer included, and they look to choose a song for the radio or two songs. The first song they choose has got to be the one that hits the radio and makes it for them. That makes the people want to buy the album. So if your song is chosen for the radio, then that's a lot of playing time. You make a lot more money for us overall financial picture of it. And if your song doesn't, they call it a B-side, and you make less because it didn't hit the radio, but you still make it off the sales.
Now, you sent an email asking people for some financial support in helping you get your songs out there. Why should people do that when the chances of anybody's song becoming a hit are not great? Why should they consider that an investment, or should they consider it more an experience than an investment?
I think you can count it as both. It's just like everything else in life. Sometimes you invest in something that doesn't pan out. It's fool's gold. And then other times you invest in something and it matures and it ends up being a windfall in the end. And sometimes you can buy a house that you think is a good piece of property, good resale property, and find out you got $30,000 worth of repairs that you didn't even see or nobody caught. It's just part of it. But with songs, where I'm at today, if I didn't get in the front door, I wouldn't ask anybody to do that. But I know that now I have something good enough to get through the front door. Their odds of making it are just like my odds. And I invested in these two songs. And once you invest in them, you're sitting out there, and it can or cannot happen. But it's the experience of it, I would think, first. And two, it's the hope that it lands on an album, because once it lands on an album, it can be anywhere from $30,000 to $300,000 return. If you were, let's just take the gamble Kenny Rogers did, that particular writer, Schultz, ended up making somewhere over $3 million off of that song right now, because it kept living and it kept going around the world, and it got on movies. The guy who wrote Grandma Got Ran Over by a Reindeer, one of the stupidest songs in Christmas, real simple song. He makes somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 a year for the last 12 years off of that one song, because it's played every Christmas around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a venture as far as adventure, and with no promising returns, but For the amount invested, it's not a large amount invested for the possibility of what can happen. And there are so many singers today that are making albums, your odds are increased a little bit by that. It's not great, but it's still increased by that.
Now, if somebody would like to get in contact with you about your music or investing in your music, how would they do that?
They can contact me two ways. They can go through email, which will be D-A-N, Dan, Hart, H-E-A-R-T, like the Oregon, 57@gmail.com, danhart57@gmail.com. The second way, they can reach me by my cell number, 251-599-5264, 251-599-5264.
Dan, thank you very much for being a guest on our show, and good luck to you.
Well, Harriet, it's been my pleasure, and I appreciate the time and that you've interviewed and been on your show.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
We are just a few weeks into the new year, but we are already getting to that juncture on the calendar where New Year's resolutions are either holding firm or are beginning to lose some of their staying power. And you might be starting to wonder if they represent realistic expectations for somebody your age in the first place. Well, the good news is that they do. And after I talk to my next guest, I will explain why that is the case. Dr. Rudd, I understand you have developed a PEMF, or pulsed electromagnetic field device. How does it work? What is that? How would you define that? And in layman's terms, so people will understand.
It produces an electromagnetic field that goes through the body or the injured tissue and repairs it.
By pulsating, by activating it?
It does a number of things. It increases the stem cells, grows the stem cells. It increases the growth factors, and it activates the extracellular matrix.
Now, these devices are now in existence, and you have one you believe is an improvement, or they are not in existence. What is the current state of this?
There are a number of PEMF devices on the market, going from ours on the low end of cost to ones that cost $20,000 and $30,000. They are all different from ours. We found something new and unique when working with NASA, and so ours is a little different, but it produces much better dramatic results.
Can you give us an example when you say dramatic results? Somebody has a large scar and it can heal. Somebody had surgery and it helps them heal from surgery. Somebody is injured and it helps them heal. What would you say are dramatic results? Give us an example of this.
Dramatic results are, if I can give a few, let me go to the animal area first and give you one. Normally, when a horse breaks its leg, they either put it down or it takes a long time to repair it. We have had broken legs in horses that we have repaired the bone within 10 days.
10 days?
10 days. In humans, we've had just recently had a professional basketball player that had meniscus surgery. They told him it would be 6 weeks before he could play again. 10 days later, he was playing.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Meniscus is part of a ligament. Can you explain that a little for us?
It's a torn cartilage in the knee, which is very difficult to repair. It's usually done surgically. He had the surgery, and let me say this, there are times when surgical repair is necessary before you use the unit. Once you have used the unit after surgery. It will tremendously increase the healing power. The unit gets rid of the inflammation and pain and makes healing grow much better.
That's really astonishing, fascinating to me. A basketball player, when you think of the amount of stress they are putting on their knees, for them to be able to heal after surgery to the point they can play professional basketball in 10 days?
I use that as an example because there's probably no greater punishment that a person puts on their knee than a professional basketball player running up and down that hardwood floor.
That's what I'm saying. And we're not just running, but jumping and moving from side
that's
to side.
Right.
Not just as if I was jogging around a track and starting and stopping and back and forth and pivoting. I mean, that's a great deal of stress, a very great deal of stress. Where do you stand now with your device? It is being used experimentally. It is being used commercially. Where do you stand with this?
We spent the first 2 years working with animals. We wanted to work with animals first, and we did some tremendous things with dogs and horses and getting them back repaired. It's all on our animal website, which is wehealanimals.com. We had a little Dachshund dog that broke its back and was paralyzed in the rear end for about 15 months. And finally, they had it on these little wheels on the back so it could walk around. And we had the owners were going to put the dog down. And my representative was in the office at the time they came in, and he said, why don't you give me a shot at seeing what I can do with it? And put the unit on. 4 days later, that dog was walking around, running around, but still needed some brain to leg coordination. 10 days later, that dog's running around, essentially healed from being paralyzed. And the movies are on the website.
That is extremely impressive, because I know dachshunds tend to have back problems anyways.
The most common injury of a dachshund is where it jumps off the bed and breaks its back.
Mm. Now, you say we. Are you working with people who are investing in this? Are you working with other scientists? You have a company?
I have a staff that works for me. Mainly, they're the distributors and sellers. I've got the real guru on electronics and cell technology, Dr. Bob Dennis, who's at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, the inventor of the device as it sits today. And I've got a rather nice staff at Hanover Investments. It's Hanover Portfolio that also works with me. And so we've got a pretty good team here working.
Now, in this show, we deal a lot with aging, so I want to take this perspective. Wouldn't this have a great deal of significance for aging? In other words, being able to heal better as you age, having your muscles work better, could it help with arthritis? Wouldn't it have a major impact on these type of things?
Yes, it does. We find that people who are very likely to get the greater benefit is the elderly. Where they've got the aches and pains and their knees are going out and so forth, and they're very happy with it because it can get rid of the pain and inflammation. It's very good at getting rid of pain and inflammation. So it makes it a lot less painful to get older.
Now, one practical concern that has to be considered in this is the expenses. What does not seem immediately obvious, do you have to go into a therapist and have sessions or treatment or therapy with these machines? Do you buy a machine and it's part of your health routine or exercise routine that you use it? How does that happen?
The device is very small. It's smaller than a pack of cigarettes. It runs off of a 9-volt battery. You charge the batteries, change the batteries every 8 hours. We always like to, when we can, have a doctor involved or a doctor to look at the person to see what the problem is, because many times the person won't know what's causing the problem. You can have, for instance, a pain in the foot that is actually a spinal problem in L4, L5, S1 on the spine. So we like to have a doctor evaluate the patient first wherever we can. Then the unit is very small. The doctor or nurse would show them how to apply it, and then they take it home with them and wear it all night for the healing process. We suggest they wear it 8 hours at night is the best time to do it, and that's what it takes. They don't have to go into the office every day or every week to have a treatment.
And would this be a very expensive device? Would it be affordable for many people?
It's, of course, very portable because you can put it in your shirt pocket. It is fairly inexpensive as these types of devices go. The unit that most people buy and the one that's used to treat animals is $800. So it's a type thing that a doctor can purchase and then rent out to patients. The professional athlete model is more expensive because it has to be more rugged. So at $800, a lot of people, when they find out what it does, say, I just want to buy the unit. I don't want to be renting it. And they just take it home and use it wherever they have the pains.
Now, if you use this unit, you use it for a prescribed length of time, you use it for life, like you might take certain medicine or wear glasses for life. A therapist tells you how long to use it. How does that happen?
Yes, well, you cannot overuse it. So we recommend that in most cases, the easiest way for people to use it is to put it on when they go to bed. They tape the coils on. The little coils are about an inch in diameter. If you've got a knee problem, for instance, you put one coil on each side of the knee and then put a wrap around the unit. There's wires that go to the coils. Just wear it all night.
And you would do this indefinitely or a prescribed period?
Oh, it's not going to be have to be indefinitely. You will find with most situations that it's going to have it healed in 10 days or less. Rarely do we go over 10 days, and usually it's much less time. For instance, women's incontinence, stress incontinence, the average is about 3 days on that.
Wow. Could it heal a knee or hip that might otherwise have to be replaced, or would it be more useful after you have that surgery?
We have a number of people that have been told, elderly people, who have been told they need a knee replacement, and they have used the unit on their knee. Now, they will use it when they start to feel any pain. So they buy the unit and use it when they need it for pain, because there's always going to be some pain without that surgical repair. But where a surgeon has said they need to replace the knee, they have used the unit to get rid of the inflammation and pain, and they still don't have the complete mobility, but it's an alternative to surgery, and it's been very successful, and they prefer to put the unit on a night a week rather than have their knee replaced.
Now, how did you happen to develop this device? Have you always been somebody who enjoys tinkering with things? Was this part of an academic situation? How did you happen to develop this?
Well, it's a different story as to academic or whatever. About 12 years ago, I started work with a company here in Houston, where I am, working with NASA, and the idea was that we would take peripheral blood, that is just like a blood sample from the arm, and we would separate the adult stem cells and grow them so that they would be available for use by the astronauts on the shuttle flight or on the space station, where you couldn't get them to an emergency room in case of an injury. You could start the treatment right away. We first started the work in a laboratory and found that when we tried to grow the cells in a flask, they would sink or stick to the side of the glass and immediately die. So how do we handle that? Well, we're working with NASA. Let's just put them on a shuttle flight where there's no gravity and see what will happen on the shuttle flight. So we put them up on a shuttle flight, and we found out they would grow very well to a therapeutic level. But we also found out there were a couple of other things that we saw. When the shuttle went in and out of the Earth's polar magnetic field, then there was a spurt in growth of the stem cells, and the media that was holding the stem cells became loaded with natural growth factors, GCSF, GM-CSF, the things that activate the healing in the body. So we came back down and devised a little device for keeping the cells from hitting the side of the wall, and then we said, what are we going to do with this effect we're seeing from the magnetic field? So we tried different things, and the first thing we tried was, and we were doing this on the little growth device, first thing we tried was a sinusoidal wave, the standard wave, and the waves are all on the website, by the way, people want to look at them. But we used a sinusoidal wave, and we got some results. But it was nothing like we were seeing on the shuttle flight. So we said we're missing something. That's when we brought Dr. Dennis in, who was a consultant for us at NASA, and the electronic expert. He's also a brilliant cell technologist. And we said, what else do we need in the wave? So we tried with different waves, and we found out that it had to be a square wave rather than a sinusoidal wave. And then we tried that, and the results were great the first time. And the next time we tried it, they were good but not great. So we said, we're missing something. And after another 2 years of research, found out that the wave had to drop off rapidly at the back end, called a slew rate. So then we had developed what the wave was, and I said to Bob, can you design this? Why are we doing this in laboratory? Can you design this where it just goes on the animal or the human where the injury is, and let's start healing it immediately after we put it on? And he came up with the device, which is two little coils that do the treatment, and they act as antenna to focus the pulsed electromagnetic field on the injury. And that's the way it works and heals.
Now, we discussed before how this device and this whole concept can have a big impact on aging, can help people heal and thrive at an older age than possibly had ever been expected. Have these discoveries changed the way you personally look at your own aging? I mean, everybody is aging. Has this had an effect on you in that way?
Yes, it has. We don't, while we're going through FDA approval, we don't like to talk a whole lot about the aging, because that will get the FDA very excited. But we do see a slowing down of the aging, or maybe even a reversal with use of the unit. I don't say that it will do that. I'm not going to make those claims because we don't have a peer-reviewed study to show that there's any effect. I don't know how you do one. But so it does have an impact. I have used it myself, and I'm very pleased with it.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking, though, on a more personal level. I understand what you're saying about the FDA. They're going to say you're making claims that cannot be substantiated, and that's not going to go over well. But has it changed how you look at aging on a personal level? Is it something you find less foreboding or frightening?
Yes, because I feel, of course, we're all going to die at some point in time, but I think this unit means that for however long you live, you're not going to go through a lot of pain or possibly can eliminate that pain in the later years, which is makes it a very slow and painful death.
Dr. Rudd, thank you very, very much for being on our show. And why don't you tell our listeners where they can get in contact with you or find out more about your device, possibly even purchase it?
They can contact me. My phone number is 832-723-8884. And there are two websites that have the email address and the phone number on it. It's wehealanimals.com and wehealplus.com. And everything we've talked about is on one of those websites. And it's got movies of the animals and what we did with them. It shows some examples of humans that have used it. So it's a very good presentation, and that's where they can find all the information.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And now for the good news about New Year's resolutions being realistic for people of all ages, I promise to share with you. Sometimes it is just a matter of making resolutions that allow you to turn the early morning hours into your special time of the day. Music is a great stress buster, so set your alarm clock to wake you up with your favorite song. Then, before you climb out of bed, spend at least 20 seconds thinking of one nice thing you can do for yourself that day. And while you're at it, you might try a few yoga poses, ones that are simple enough, but that stretch your mind and body while they also build up your endurance. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you will tune in for our next show.